Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, a panel discussion with two of our favorites. Melanie Mason is a senior political reporter at Politico, leading a lot of their coverage here in California. And Mike Murphy is a Republican political strategist who years ago broke with Donald Trump, is the co-host of the popular Hacks on Tap podcast, and is the co-director of the USC Center for the Political Future. Both of them talk about a big week in politics. Among the issues this week, the Signalgate, what happened in terms of sharing what some describe as classified information on the app Signal? What's up with these Democratic town halls and the state of the Democratic Party right now? Governor Newsom's podcast, what do we make of that? What do we make of the moves of Matt Mahan, the mayor of San Jose? And the race for California governor. All of that discussed in this extended conversation with Melanie and Mike. Here it is.
Welcome back to you both. Good to see you.
Thank you.
So last week, we had Julia Louis-Dreyfus on The Issue Is. And the big story in the country this week felt like something out of Veep. We're talking about the Signal controversy. We'll show you some video. Congress now investigating a text messaging group on the encrypted app Signal, which included top national security officials, attack plans for Yemen, and an accidental invite for the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg. White House says no big deal.
We have taken every question under the sun about this story, and the national security advisor has taken responsibility for this mistake.
Some Democrats are calling for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to resign for putting out these plans on an app which many national security experts say could have been hacked by a foreign nation. Mike, your thoughts?
Well, it's unbelievable. It's a clown car. I mean, this in the old Republican days, we would make a lot of noise about things one-tenth as big as this, where like a bunch of giggling frat bros are all on the text, hey, we're going to use the new Missile 28. So on one hand, it's hilarious, clown car, new era we're in, craziness. On the other hand, this is putting American military people at risk. There's a thing called a SCIF, which is basically a room that can't be bugged. And that's where most classic security conversations will happen, classified. And these guys are tweeting like talking about the Taylor concert. So, you know, I'm not normally speechless. This thing is such an insult to the military, such a lack of respect. And I think the headline to it is the way they've reacted to it is the other half of the story. There is no shame. Nobody resigns. Nobody takes responsibility. It's just this locust think of me, 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 us, we're great, own the left. And so I kind of feel like a lot of world leaders do, I think, that just much above my level. But this is America now.
Yeah, and Hillary Clinton put out an op-ed saying this is not only dumb, but it's dangerous. Of course, she was criticized so much for mishandling classified information. That's potentially the criticism here. But Melanie, it seems like President Trump doesn't want anybody to resign or be fired because that would be a win for the media.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, this is a, like, make no apologies administration. That was one of the things I think that they learned from their first term when Mike Flynn had to resign. I think that President Trump,
who was the national security advisor then, Mike Waltz, national security advisor now.
Exactly.
Mike Flynn had to resign very early on in the administration.
And I think that Trump took, the lesson he took away from that was, you know, never surrender again. The very fact that we heard this administration using the word mistake, I can't think of the last time that I've heard a Trump affiliated person using that word, which just goes to show they know that this was a massive, massive screw-up.
But the question, Mike, do average people care? Because I don't know how many people are using Signal to begin with. A lot of these national security issues seem foreign compared to, like, an issue like tariffs on cars,
which
is a big issue that people can really understand.
No, I mean, I think this thing drives the bigger narrative of, wait a minute, we fired the guy we had because he was too old and inflation was too high. This guy will fix the economy. Instead, we're getting, you know, plans to grab Greenland. Apparently, our new enemies are not the Russians, they're the Canadians. You know, they're getting this craziness, and I think that builds. This says amateur incompetence. Mm-hmm. So I think in the big narrative, it's bad for them. But you're right. The things that will really potentially hurt President Trump politically are if he doesn't keep the promise he was elected on, which is make the economy work. And when you put 25% tariff on imported cars. Go ask a Honda dealer how they feel about that, even though Honda makes about 80% of their cars here already. Mm. But the North American auto economy is heavily integrated. Mm-hmm. So this means, you know, 4 years after you got your truck, you're going to go in if these tariffs stick. And you're going to say, wait a minute, why does it cost $10,000 more than it did before? Well, because Donald Trump's mad at Canada. Yeah. You know, tariffs are economic poison. Bad economies wipe out political parties. And so they're on those railroad tracks now.
And that is an issue, Melanie. When we talked to voters in the fall, so many of them talked about the issue of prices, that they wanted prices to go down. That, to me, seems like the biggest vulnerability if prices are going up and the economy is going down.
Absolutely. And this was always the advantage that President Trump had in the campaign, right? When people rated him on the issues, it was issues like the economy that they trusted right. him on more. And now we're already seeing those numbers start to go underwater. I mean, the fact that we see such disapproval already about his economic handling, the fact we're seeing consumer sentiment continually decline, people start getting worried about things like a recession. As you said, I think that that could be poison for an administration and somebody who I think got a lot of leeway from the voters about his economic handling in the past.
But still, the Democratic poll numbers are even worse. I mean, they're in the tank right now. And a lot of people have given President Trump credit for doing a lot of what he promised and looking like a strong leader right now, where the Democrats look like they're in the wilderness. There's been this effort to do town halls in Republican districts. We saw Jimmy Gomez was out in Bakersfield doing that. He's a Democrat from Los Angeles. We've got some video of that. He challenging the district where David Valadao is. He's considered one of the most vulnerable Republicans. Ro Khanna, also a Democratic congressman, went to that same district in Bakersfield, did a few others in Southern California. Melanie, you were there talking to voters. What did voters tell you?
Well, first of all, I think that they feel a little bit neglected and just sort of at a loss of, like, who do they go to? So congratulations. If you live in Bakersfield, you are going to be getting so much attention now from Democrats because this is a district. This is the district. David Valadao's district is the district with the highest percentage of Medicaid enrollees in the entire state. Mm. And if there are cuts to Medicaid, which is what's being discussed in Washington right now, that district will be affected. And so that's why you see these Democrats coming in. But what they wanted to do was rail against the Republicans. The voters wanted to do was express their frustration with their own party right now. I think they see the Democratic Party as just kind of directionless. What are they doing? What I heard over and over again is, what is your plan? What are our marching orders? Voters want to have a sense that there's somebody at the wheel at the Democratic Party. And I think that these Democrats are going into these districts. I think it's smart to show that they're present and active, but they don't have good answers, because the truth is they don't hold any levers of power, and therefore there's not a really satisfying thing to tell these voters.
Melanie, you're the reporter on the ground. Mike, you're the strategist. Mm-hmm. If you were coming up with a strategy right now for the Democrats, who are poll numbers in the 20s, Is that an effective strategy, going and doing town halls in other people's districts?
No, it's an effective tactic. I mean, I've been in this business a long time, and I've never seen the Republican National Committee, which I ran once, Republican National Congressional Committee, tell incumbents, whatever you do, don't hold a town hall meeting, even in a safe Republican district. So the Democrats being fast on their feet, saying, ha ha, we're do it. We're going down to Vallejo. Valdeo, who, by the way, is like the roadrunner. He's got the toughest district in America for Republicans, yet they can never beat him.
But they beat him once.
Yeah, that's true.
He lost one election.
But everybody thought he'd get it last time. Yeah. And so it's good tactics. We're talking about it. But from a strategic point of view, the Democrats have no idea what to do, and they're fragmented. Chuck Schumer is not a wartime leader of the Democratic Party. But what I would tell them is similar to what I think Carville's been saying, which is, you don't have to be that good right now. Retreat into the vast Russian steppe and let Trump keep being Trump, because the numbers are dropping. And, you know, it's good therapy for the Democrats now to feel like we're doing something and everything, but nothing counts till Election Day of the midterms. So recruiting those candidates, building that infrastructure, and getting the loony left out of the Democratic spotlight are the things they need to do, and we'll see if they do it.
But that's not what a lot of the Democrats you talk to want to hear, right?
No, well, they want to just feel like there's something that can be done between now and November of 2026. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is what's really hard. And so, yes, I think you just see this fragmentation, as you point out. Here's the other problem for the Democrats. The Democrats are the party of good government. So Chuck Schumer, for example, doesn't want to shut down because he thinks that there will be catastrophic consequences in terms of the operations of government. That's not something that this Republican Party is very concerned about right now. It's a very asymmetric sort of power dynamic, and Democrats kind of have their hands tied.
Yeah, it's kind of a tragedy, but the Democrats want to win by being reasonable and getting praised by the New York Times. That works in a reasonable time in American politics. We are not. We're in a crazy outlaw chainsaw fight time. And so Schumer with his 17-point plan and the guy next to him at the rally waving the cane, they're all 118. I get the respect for institution. I wish it was a world where that worked, but they understand. They're fighting a giant octopus that shoots fire, doesn't believe in rules. So they've got to switch up their tactics.
Yeah.
And it's hard for them to do, but that's the world they're in.
Congressman Al Green's cane waving may not be the way to get the TikTokers.
No. It was Grandpa Simpson there. It's time for change. You know, it's unbelievable.
Well, so speaking of the Democratic response, Governor Newsom is out with his latest podcast. It features Ezra Klein, who is a liberal columnist from the New York Times, whose new book, Abundance, documents how many liberal policies haven't worked in blue states like California.
Legally binding goal, 2.5 million units by 2030. And that is the established state policy. And that's the goal.
So you're not on track for that?
Not even close.
Why?
For a number of reasons. Macroeconomic. I mean, I think you have to be fair as it relates to the realities of what just occurred as it relates to the constraints around the markets.
You're saying that interest rates are
high. Interest rates are high. Obviously, we came out of a very difficult period during COVID.
So there he is talking about housing and the fact, which is the biggest issue in the state, and the fact that he's nowhere close to building enough housing to deal with many issues, including homelessness. Melanie, how do you think this podcast is playing?
Overall, I think the podcast concept is a little questionable, but I have to say that this episode, I thought it was the best.
By far.
And I think that there were a couple of reasons, because I think that when he had folks like Charlie Kirk on or Steve Bannon on, it was almost like he was on this safari trying to understand like a species that he doesn't understand. And he was like, I think, oddly sort of just kind of conciliatory in a way that wasn't very compelling to listen to, and I think very disappointing for liberal Democrats. This was a substantive conversation about true critiques that Ezra Klein and others have about liberal governance. And yes, the governor was defensive at times, but he also, you know, I think really engaged on the substance of this. It wasn't the like sexiest conversation, but it was, if people are interested in actually what I think is one of the biggest conversations the Democratic Party actually has to have with itself, this was it. I actually thought it was quite good.
Yeah, I mean, the podcast is called This Is Gavin Newsom, and I feel like this was the most podcast that was Gavin Newsom. This is the Gavin Newsom that we've known for many years behind the scenes, way more than we saw in the other ones, but apparently there isn't as much of an audience for nerdy policy talk.
This is the audience, which is why
you don't see it going as viral or making as many headlines. But if you actually want to understand him better, that's the podcast to go to. But your thoughts on where the governor
is?
Well,
a lot of forces clashing here. Read Abundance is really good.
Yeah,
and
it's really good.
It's a powerful argument Democrats need to hear about Democrats. Second, I want to get a Crocodile Dundee hat like that guy I just saw going
Michael
by.
Michael Savage.
Oh, that was Savage. Okay, I couldn't quite see him on the monitor. So there's a big debate about this in Washington political geek circles. Most of them think it's the stupidest thing in the world. These are partisan Democrats. They go, he's giving that guy air time. You ought to put handcuffs on him. Bring in, you know, AOC to throw a net on him. That's the kind of, you know, fight. What's he doing hanging out with them?
Yeah.
What a lot of the Newsom people will say is the biggest problem being Gavin Newsom thinking about running for president way out in California is nobody cares. You know, you're too distant from the political central nervous system. Mm-hmm. What are we talking about? Gavin Newsom is getting clicks. He's now out there in the middle of the deal, which Newsom world has always been a little thirsty to do. Remember, they were putting up billboards and I'm being nice. But we're putting up billboards. Take that, Alabama, you know, right. National press. I'm here. I'm going to debate Ron DeSantis. So, you know, if I were a Newsom for president person, I'd be worried about the thirstiness and the cynicism gimmickry of it a little. But if their mission is to put him in the middle of the debate, and now they have done a little move over to the thoughtful Democratic thing, which I thought was very smart. They did a few freak shows, now move on. Maybe out in voter world, outside the Beltway, which is often wrong about everything, this thing will have some traction. But most of the Dem Mandarins think it's stupid.
You wonder, in the post-Trump era, are we in a post-shame era?
I think we are.
You know what I mean? And so just getting attention and controlling the dialogue, whether you're shameless in doing it or thirsty, yeah, may not matter. Maybe that's one of the lessons that he's learned from all this.
Oh, I predict a Democratic presidential primary candidate will wind up in a cage of Joe Rogan before the New Hampshire primary, just for the clicks.
Yeah, that's not the craziest thing I've heard.
Let's talk for a moment, though, about some of what they were talking about, which is this fight of where the Democratic Party goes from here. Mm-hmm. One example of a different approach is the mayor of San Jose, Matt Mahan, who has a different approach even than Governor Newsom. We talked to him on the show a couple weeks ago here. He is putting forward a policy to potentially arrest homeless people who, after multiple outreaches, refuse shelter that the city is providing. Now, that policy, which could sound common sense to a whole lot of folks, is not to the folks in Sacramento. There's a state senator named Sasha Renee Perez. We've got some video of her. She is now pitching a bill to make what Matt Mahan's trying to do illegal, to say you can't do that. And this fight is a real fight, and what Matt Mahan is doing here is notable, Melanie.
Well, and I think it says a lot about the mayor in general and kind of the path he's trying to carve for himself. I mean, there's nothing more I think that he would love than the fact that there's a Democratic senator who's introducing a bill trying to smack him down. That's a fight that he wants. Another interesting thing he did recently was wade into the Oakland mayoral race, where he endorsed the person running against former Congresswoman Barbara Lee, kind of going against the Democratic establishment there. I mean, that's a pretty bold move for a mayor to sort of stick his neck out into a city that is not his own. Yeah. And to sort of say to the Democratic establishment, I'm ready to throw some bombs here. I'm ready to, you know, tussle a little bit. And whether it's this tussle in Sacramento or in Oakland, I think that he is trying to say, I'm not going to be in lockstep with what the Democratic Party has been for the last couple of years.
And he did that on Proposition 36, which was a tougher on crime bill that all the statewide Democrats said don't vote for. He said vote for. And he won 70-30.
Big.
So maybe there's a market for this.
Oh, I think there definitely
is.
I think the average long-suffering California voter is saying, well, I can go with the loony left who can't run anything, or I got Trump Republican world, and they're too busy invading Greenland. So where can I go to get decent government for the massive taxes we pay? And I think there's a growing move toward common sense in the Democratic Party, and he's at the vanguard of it, which is, you know what? If homeless people, often with drug problems, won't get help, and we're spending billions to try to help them, maybe we have to compel them a little. Mm. And then you get the chorus, like the state senator saying, no, 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 we should put them on the state flag. You know, they're special. I don't buy that. I don't think many voters do. So I think you're going to see this kind of radical, middle-of-the-road frustration within the Democratic Party against the folks who are owned for the status quo. They own it. It's not good in the cities, in the legislature, and maybe try something new.
So that could be something that you are doing in the governor's race.
I'm not running.
We're gonna
I know
about,
the country.
People
very disappointing
will pay you a lot
news.
Of money to tell them to say that. So we'll be getting into that next here on The Issue is the governor's race. You have new reporting on this. The big question looming over that governor's race, what's the deal with Kamala Harris? Is she going to get in? Is she going to get out? There's new pressure on her. We'll get into that when we come back here on The Issue is. We've already started talking about the governor's race. You have a favorite?
Well, I've said that Kamala Harris would be an amazing candidate and an amazing governor. I would support her if she chooses to run, but there'll be plenty of time for politics in getting closer to that. Right now, the most important election in front of us is going to be the House elections in 2026.
Which is the same time, though, as the governor's race. Katie Porter is running, who used to be one of your colleagues in the House. You're not endorsing her, then?
Katie's a friend. She's a powerful force, an amazing communicator. What I've said is that Kamala Harris would be an amazing executive to the fifth largest economy.
That's Pete Aguilar of San Bernardino, chair of the House Democrats. Here are the current candidates running for governor for next year's race. Remember, this field likely to get even more crowded. Back with our panel, political strategist Mike Murphy and Melanie Mason of Politico. Melanie, you're all over this governor's race. You just did an event. We have some video of it at the University of California. This is with the former mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa, talking about his run for governor. And when you asked him about Kamala Harris, he looked right in the camera and had a direct message for her.
The governor's race is not going to be a coronation. The governor's race is not a stepping stone to another job. If you want to be governor, any of the candidates, then get in the race. The time is now. The challenges are too big. We deserve a real conversation. We had a 100-day campaign. So no, you can't get in at the end of the rainbow. Get in now. Let's have that conversation. I look forward to it respectfully.
Okay,
that
was quite clear.
Well, she's out now.
What were your big takeaways from talking with him for about an hour?
Yeah, I love the respectfully at the end of his comments because he was so ready for, you know, obviously it's the obvious question, right? We're asking about what is going to happen with the former vice president and more importantly, what's going to happen to the rest of the field. I mean, the signals that we were seeing both publicly and behind the scenes was that everybody was sort of not everybody. Most candidates were thinking about what their next move would be if she got in the race, the idea that she would clear the field. And so the fact that you saw the former mayor of Los Angeles look directly into the camera and say, I'm not getting out of this race and I'm going to. And by the way, not only that, hurry up and get in this race so we can actually have this conversation. Now, there are two reasons for this. One, I think he's a little bored and I think he wants to actually see this campaign get off and running. And I think that there is a robust conversation to be had with voters. The second is that this race is frozen right now. Yep. Donors are waiting to find out who is going to be in this race. They're not going to write big checks unless they know what the field looks like. And so I think that there's this state of limbo that not just the former mayor, but other candidates as well are getting pretty impatient.
Right, because you think about it, the whole reason that they get in this early is because they got to raise money, right? You got to raise, what, $100 million, something like that, to be able to run in this state, especially if you're running against somebody who has 100% name ID in Kamala Harris, but a lot of those donors don't want to give their money when they don't know what the field's going to look like. What do you think of Kamala Harris's calculus right now?
Well, I think she's trying to figure it out. I think she would be a weak front runner. I mean, there was an impact poll floating around, big Democratic polling firm. She has 99% name ID, but she only has a third of the voters for her. So that's probably enough to be a, you know, remember, we have this June system where everybody's on one ballot. So she would be leading, but she's kind of like the candy bar that the kids sniff and don't always want. You know, there's a product problem there. There's a question on that poll about, do you think she should run or do you think she had her chance for president? The Democrats ought to find somebody else. And, you know, around 60% of Democrats say, yes, she ought to run. But 70% of everybody else says, hell no. So point is, she's going to have to earn this. Antonio's actually right. Do I think she's going to run or not? I have absolutely no idea. I do know that there are very few voters in this state other than like relatives and campaign staff that want the race to begin tomorrow. So she has more time than
even
people.
We don't.
Yeah, no, no. She has more time business than people think, because the money thing is going to wait on her. Yeah. But it's not enough. I think former Secretary Becerra is taking a hard look at the race. Yep. Katie Porter's in, though she says, I'm in, but I'm not really in, but wait for Kamala, which is weird. And then you've got other candidates. So it's going to be a while. And if she does get in, I think she'll be formidable, but not overwhelming.
Okay, so you are advising Rick Caruso.
Longtime friend.
Yeah. Longtime friend. Okay. Yeah. We know that he is considering whether to run for mayor or for governor. What's the deal? What's going on?
Well, I have an announcement. No, I won't do it. So here's the deal. Rick is focused on Steadfast LA. And
which is to rebuild
the Palisades and Altadena.
But he's also thinking about.
Well, I'll tell you, we joke, there are two phones on the desk. One is people saying, you got to run for governor. The state ought to lead America, and it could be so great.
Yeah.
And we got nine different flavors of the same running right now. You know, the people, the architects of the current thing, if you love that, vote for them. And other people saying, this city needs a mayor. A mayor who doesn't have more frequent flyer points than any other mayor in America when the city's on fire.
Okay.
And so Rick is who he is, you know, a common sense, get it done kind of guy. Think stuff through. So he's hearing all of it. He's thinking about it. He's doing a very sound approach. I can tell you when I call him up and said, hey, I got to come see you. There's some county commissioner in Fresno. He's like, yeah, I'm a Steadfast for 5 days. I'll try to find. So there's no big news coming out of there. But there's certainly an opportunity, and I've been in politics a long time. I have never seen as much support from different areas that were not there last time you ran. I didn't work on that campaign, but I observed it closely, ringing that this is a time for a person like you.
So when you call, Which mm-hmm. which one are you on? Are you pushing for mayor or for governor?
I'm on the bat phone. I'm calling to say, can I get one of those passes at the Grove, the park for free anytime?
Okay.
But no, he bounces stuff off me. And, you know, I can make a really strong case either way. But I can tell you, he's in no rush. His goal is steadfast right now.
Yeah.
Because there's stuff happening. If you start looking at Altadena versus Pasadena, Altadena's getting it done quicker because the city has been a mixed bag on this, and we're all trying to work together, but he's got a big job there.
And he doesn't have to raise as much money as everybody else.
Oh, well, he does.
I
mean, the truth is, when you raise money, you also raise political support.
Right.
But let me just say that I think if he decided to run, based on his message and who he is, we would raise enough money, and he can always contribute something that would be a very competitive campaign.
Your thoughts.
I just want to say it is important to note that the timeline constraints that apply to all of these other candidates don't necessarily apply to Rick Caruso because he does have significant personal resources and also supporters who I think he'd be able to raise money quite quickly. But when you have the ability to tap into your own personal funds, then you don't have to worry about running up and down the state, you know, for 9 months in advance of when things are going on. So I do think it's important to note one of these candidates is not like the other, and I think it is because of his immense sort of personal resources.
Well, two of these candidates, Kamala Harris and Rick Caruso, both can wait, and it feels like they
are. The other thing, just if you look at the polling, very few of these candidates are known.
Yep.
And that adds to that problem. In the L.A. market, Rick is very well known and very well liked. And Kamala is very well known and not so much, but, you know, clusters of support for sure. The others have an uphill climb to get into that A tier.
So, at the end of the day, which do you think he does?
He's always wanted to anchor a public affairs.
He's taking
program.
My job. That's what we're doing. Yeah.
You get to be governor. We're work something out.
All right.
Stay tuned.
I take that trade.
There will be plenty of news at the right time.
Yeah, okay.
Our thanks to Melanie and Mike, and our thanks to you for listening. Next week, a issue is debate. We're going to be talking with Gloria Allred and John Phillips together for a debate. Should be a lot of fun. For now, I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks so much for listening. Send us notes and social media. Love to hear from you. Let people know about our show. Like, subscribe, all the good stuff. See you next week for more of The Issue Is.